This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It's a gorgeous day today. We've had a series of gorgeous days today. It is Thursday. I don't think I'm coming in tomorrow unless there's a big problem, which everything's been puttering along. So I think we're going to be good. My mom's birthday is today. She is 89 today. My dad, as I've said before, is 92 and 10 months now, because we're at the stage where we count months. So I have some longevity genes, and I'm going to take full use of that and do the best I can. I called my brother last Saturday because I hadn't given him an update on my dad in a while, and so I called him on Saturday. The first thing he said when he picked up the phone, I could tell he was in a commercial business. He works at a music store, one of the things he does, and my brother's 5 years older than I am, and as soon as he picked up the phone, I thought, oh, he's busy. Rats. And he said, now, is this an emergency phone call or something like that? And I said, no, everything's fine. Everything is fine. Okay, good. So then we chatted for a little while, and I just gave him a quick update while he was working there behind the counter and got that all done. But at one point when I was telling him about Dad, he said, you know, I don't think I want to live that long. And I said, well, Wink, here's the deal. I said, we've got these longevity genes. You know, all of my mom's folks, they all were long livers. And as far as Dad goes, his people, the oldest anyone got in his immediate family was about 72. But he's 92. So he is an outlier when it comes to that. Which probably means that on average, I and my brother are going to live into our 90s if something doesn't catch us first. So I am doing my best to lay that foundation of high functionality when I get into my 90s, because I have lots of books to write, and the higher my functionality in older age, the better I will be at writing. So it's all very interesting. Anyways, so there you go. A little anecdote from work that I'm going to be touching on in a minute, but aside from that, work is going well, all this puttering along, making some good progress there. I had a lovely breakfast with a friend this morning. You know, getting together with friends, it's a good thing. It's just good. You get together, you share your hearts, you talk about stuff that's going on. They know stuff you don't know. You might know some stuff they don't know. It's good. Highly recommend it. I highly recommend it. It's just a great way to be in touch with life. Get together over a meal. Talk about stuff. Anyways, still writing, working on the fourth book in the Windfall series. This one is called Windfall, A Seed in Secret. As I've said in the past, this one is going to be about the very interesting parable of the growing seed. Fascinating parable. And that's coming along fine. I actually hit 10,000 words in 1 week last week. I'm not sure I'm going to hit that this week, but I will probably hit my goal of 8,000 without too much trouble. I think I'm already up to 6,500 this week. So if I put another 500 in this evening, which is the goal, that gets me to 7,000. Friday, I think, pretty much is going to be a bust. It's going to be one of those days, because I finally get to harvest some sauerkraut on Friday. Yay! I haven't had sauerkraut for 2 or 3 weeks. I've been missing it. But Friday, I get to harvest my sauerkraut. I'm excited about that. That's going to be fun. But I also have a doctor's appointment for my dad on Friday, so I'll probably take my computer and try to do a little bit of writing. But by the time I get the sauerkraut harvested, and then by the time I get a new batch made, and by the time I get a little exercising done and all that kind of stuff, there's not going to be much time for writing. However, I have topped 3,000 words in a day, so it's always conceivable that I might get caught up on Saturday and might be able to plow through and actually get 10,000 words done this week as well, which would be cool. Because if I could get myself cranked up to 10,000 words a week, whoo, I could get one of these books done in like 12 weeks. That would be fabulous. That would be really fabulous. But we'll see. It's all going well. I think it's going to be interesting. It's fun so far. I'm liking it. So it's good. It's good. It's good. Starting to hear back from a few beta readers. They've so far are liking book three. And I even had one beta reader who had been with me on earlier books, which were Sweetness and Light and all that kind of thing. And I told her when she got in on this series, I said, okay, this stuff is gritty. This is not those books. This is very much adult, and it's, you know, it's going to make you twinge for a reason. It's not just gratuitous. So she wrote me back when I started it, and she said, you said it would be gritty. She said, but she expressed some things that were going on in her own life and how it was, she felt like it was helping her view those in a different way. And I said, great, absolutely great. And then she got done with them and she said, I'm going to have my husband give me the first two books in this series as part of my birthday. So that was cool. It's like, hey, I offered just to send her the PDF since she was a beta reader. And she said, no, I like real books. I said, okay, well, thanks. So that's good. That's good. You know, if I do all this work and I only affect one person by reading these books, that's enough for me. Anyways, so all is well there, all is well there, all is well there. This week, I had some other things I was going to talk about, and this is actually going to turn into a two-week deal. Because my daughter sent me an article, and then in the process of preparing to talk about this article, there was a link to another article, and I thought, oh, I want to do that, but by the time I pasted the text from both of the articles into my notes for today, the notes were like 21 pages, and I knew there was no way I was going to get through all of that, so I just dropped back to the first article I was going to do. We'll talk about that, and then next week we'll probably talk about the next article. This article my daughter sent me, she put in her little note to me. She went, yep, yep. And I opened it up, and I thought, well, this should be interesting. And sure enough, after I got looking at it, I thought, well, this was interesting. Especially because it agrees with me. You know, I'm always happy to talk about stuff that agrees with my viewpoint. So I wrote her back. I said, yeah, it's good. I said, and it sounds vaguely familiar. And I put a smiley face on it because she knows she's been hearing me talk about this kind of stuff. Not in these exact terms, but pretty similar and easily mappable. And maybe even a bit more explainable once you plug this information into the framework of flesh and spirit. And maybe plugging this information into the framework of flesh and spirit helps to explain why this works. So the title of the article was How Never to Get Angry: Three New Secrets from Neuroscience. So, it's always good to be supported by neuroscience. Anyway, so this was by Eric Barker, and he describes the situation just right off the bat, the guy who was writing the article. He says, they're 1 inch from your face, boiling with rage, screaming and yelling at you. All you want to do is scream and yell back, but you know that's not going to be good for anyone. He said, I've talked before about how to deal with others who are angry and irrational. And that's where the link was to the other thing. And I thought, oh, I may need to talk about that. But how do you control those emotions in yourself? It says, looking at neuroscience, there's a wrong way to do it and a right way to do it. So let's dig into the research of how to get rid of anger, what you're doing wrong, how to do it right, and how you can make those, you and those around you much happier. Okay, so good. This is a good topic. So he starts off by saying suppressing anger is rarely a good idea, which I agree with. He says, you know, you can grit your teeth and hold it. I'm fine. That's not good. Because you really haven't changed anything. And if you're still listening to those voices inside your head and they're still stirring you up, he doesn't necessarily go into that. And that's why I say I think the framework of flesh and spirit provides more of an understanding of the mechanisms that are actually going on. But he just says we need to recognize that just clamping down our emotions and just trying to grit our teeth until we can get out the door is not really going to be beneficial. He was talking about when experimental subjects were told of an unhappy event, but then instructed to try not to feel sad about it, they ended up feeling worse than people who are informed of the event, but given no instructions on how to feel. Said in another study, patients who were suffering from panic disorders listened to relaxation tapes. When they listened to their hearts beat faster than patients who listened to audiobooks with no explicit relaxing content. Bereaved people who make the most effort to avoid feeling grief, research suggests, take the longest to recover from their loss. So sometimes you just gotta acknowledge what you're feeling and not try to stuff it down. He says in here, you clamp down on your emotions and the other person's blood pressure spikes, and they like you less. Studies show that over the long haul, this can lead to lousy relationships that aren't as rewarding. So if somebody's upset with you and you just glare at them, you're not gonna say anything, but really mad at you. But that's not ultimately gonna be very good for you. So the first step is, don't just try to act like your anger doesn't exist. Don't just try to clamp down and just boil inside. That's not a solution. But neither is it a solution to vent your anger. Okay, you just don't want to, start punching the wall or punching the pillow or yell and rant, stomp around, rah, 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 just because you're mad. That's not a solution either. And he goes on and actually, shows why studies say this isn't. Again, doesn't really explain what the mechanism is that's going on, but we'll get to that in a minute. So he says he's quoting from this book called The Handbook on Emotion Regulation. He said, focusing on a negative emotion will likely intensify the experience of the emotion further and thus make down-regulation more difficult, leading to lower adjustment and well-being. And then he talks about the marshmallow experiment, which I've talked about that before on the podcast. They bring little kids into the room, put a marshmallow on the table in front of them, and they say, now I'm going to leave the room. You can eat the marshmallow, but if you eat the marshmallow, that's it. But if you don't eat the marshmallow, I'll give you another marshmallow when you come back, and you can eat both. And they said, it's really about impulse control, is what you're testing there. And they said, even as early as 5 years old, I think they've said that the children with impulse control that were able to say, okay, well, I'll just wait, or found a way to help themselves wait, that they did better in school, they did better with discipline, they did better, 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 because there's an explanation for that within the flesh-spirit framework that we'll get to in a minute. But what was interesting is they were talking about how that some of these children dealt with this. They didn't just clamp down and go, oh, I don't want. They recognized that they wanted the marshmallow, but then they went and had other activities. They distracted themselves. Sometimes they sang to themselves. Sometimes they counted their toes. Sometimes they just did whatever they could to not think about, you know, the marshmallow. Not necessarily sit there and grit their teeth, but by the same token, not just give in to that feeling. So they're quoted in this article as saying, successful delayers created all sorts of ways to distract themselves. They transformed the aversive waiting situation by inventing imaginative fun distractions that took the struggle out of willpower. They composed little songs, made funny and grotesque faces, picked their noses, cleaned their ear canals, toyed with what they discovered there, and created games with their hands and their feet, playing with their toes as if they were piano keys. But what works, what works. That's fine. But beyond simply not trying to clamp down on your anger, but beyond not simply venting your anger, is really what I think is the key, and there's a reason that it's a key, and it is, in fact, I don't have in my system, typically when I talk to people about anger, I don't have three keys to keep yourself from getting anger. I have one. And it's this last one. I don't use this particular term, but I use another example, and it's exactly what this is. And the term they use is reappraisal. And it basically comes back to, you're in this situation, someone is screaming at you. So what's your instinctive response? Your instinctive response is to hit them. It's to scream back. And then the writer of the article goes on to say, but what if I told you that their mother passed away yesterday, or that they were going through a tough divorce and they just lost custody of their kids? The way I express this in Still Whispers is, when I was talking about anger, as I said, let's say you're driving down the street and someone cuts you off and that rage immediately springs up within you. Why are they cutting me off? Oh, they saw, they knew I was here. Why aren't they watching what they're doing? I said, you know, the amazing thing is if you restructure that just a little bit, if you think, well, maybe they just learned that their wife was sent to the hospital. Maybe they just learned that their child was in an accident and they're trying to get there. Maybe they just had a really bad day at work and they're trying to deal with that and they're just wanting to get home. Because as soon as you re-image that, as soon as you try to see it from the other person's viewpoint, as soon as in the terms of this article, you reappraise the situation, it's amazing how those things just dissipate. And that experience of those emotions dissipating is really one of the keys, I think, to understand what's happening below the surface. And we'll get to that in just a minute. They said in this article, okay, what if you found out that they just lost custody of their kids? They said, well, you'd let it go. You'd probably even respond to their anger with compassion. They said, what changed? Not the event. The situation is the same, but the story that you're telling yourself about the event has changed. And then they gave a little quote from a researcher that I thought it was really a good quote. As famed researcher Albert Ellis said, you don't get frustrated because of events. You get frustrated because of your beliefs. That's absolutely true. It's not quite what I say in the framework of flesh and spirit, but it's absolutely true. So where does this all fit within the framework of flesh and spirit? Well, as I said, I don't really have three elements that I talk to people when I talk to them about anger. I have one. Because the first two, this idea of holding things in and just stewing over them, I handle that in just the basic understanding of flesh and spirit. And how I handle that is I say, you know, we have this multitude of voices within us. And it's very much like the societal class consciousness of the angel on one shoulder and the demon on another. I'm getting my mail, one moment. And the demon is sitting there going, oh, I can't believe they did that. It was ridiculous. What do they think they're doing? That voice that is angry, that is looking for vengeance, that is envious, that is rageful, that voice that is unmerciful, that voice is easily identified as flesh. And just as a basic rule within the framework, we say flesh leads to destruction, spirit leads to life. So you don't even need to know the long-term plan that the flesh has in mind when it's sitting down there and churning you up and getting you, I'm backing into my ranch, getting you to say, oh, I can't believe that person did that to me. You don't even need to know what that is. You can recognize the way that voice feels within you. And you can know, yeah, this is flesh. I don't need to listen to this. This is not where I want to be. The same thing really comes into play when you're talking about venting. When those voices are in your head and you start giving them voice and you are venting, I can't believe you did that to me. Okay. All you're doing is you're playing into the game that the flesh has invented for you. And then whenever you play into the flesh's game, whenever you listen to what the flesh is telling you, whenever you respond to it, you make it stronger. You make it easier for it to get to you the next time and the next time and the next time. And invariably, it is leading you down to a path of destruction. So the first two are really kind of just taken care of in just the basic framework of flesh and spirit. That third one, though, that reappraisal, that looking at things from other people's viewpoint, it really comes back to understanding how the flesh manipulates us. And the flesh manipulates us by creating beliefs that directly impact our self-concept, because it knows that the way to evoke emotion in us is by impacting our self-concept. So when we're driving down the road and someone cuts us off, the story that the flesh tells us is that person cut you off on purpose. They saw you were in that lane. They pulled right in front of you. They didn't care whether you were going to have an accident or not. As far as they were concerned, if you ran off the road and killed yourself, they could care less, because all they were thinking about was their self. They weren't thinking about the effect it was going to have on you. They just cut in front of you because they felt that their time was more important than your time. These are the lies that the flesh constructs. These are the stories that the flesh tells us. It's always about, you are being diminished by this. You are nothing in terms of this person. It's always attacking our self-value and our self-definition. And what's important in dealing with the flesh is to shine a light on those stories that the flesh is trying to tell us, and exposing them for the lies they are. I have a little saying, whenever you feel the flesh rising up in you, try to figure out what lie the flesh is telling you about yourself. I'm worthless. I'm no good. Nobody likes me. Rah, 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 rah. I was just talking to an associate this week, and he said, yeah, he said, I always feel like, you know, I'm always telling myself, you know, no one wants to work with me. No one this, no one that, no one. You know, I was telling him, buddy, don't listen to that voice. That voice is lying to you. Don't listen to that voice. And why it's effective to do reappraisal, why it works, is because when you swing your focus outward and you say, you know, it could be that that person just wasn't watching where they were going when they cut me off. I mean, I've done that. It could be they did receive some bad news. Could be their wife is in the hospital or their kids were in a wreck, or could be they've had a really bad day or they just got fired. And when you look at it from that perspective, all of a sudden you realize, you know, this person's behavior in all likelihood has nothing to do with me. And when you swing that focus that way, all of a sudden, this person's behavior has nothing to do with my self-concept or self-definition. He just may be, or she just may be, a lousy driver. And once that happens, that emotion, it just eases out and goes away. And the flesh gives up trying because it knows it's lost traction. So while the article was good, and I thought, you know, what they were saying at the surface level, it's that, yeah, bing, good job, you know. I think there's much more explanation as to what is happening here and what the real dynamics are if you plug it into a flesh versus spirit framework and you understand that the flesh constantly tells us lies about our self-concept and self-value and self-definition. And that's one of its main tools to get us worked up, is to tell us lies about those things. And if you can attack those lies, if you can shine some light on them, it goes away. I told you I'd tell you a little incident about work. I spent 3 hours today chasing down a problem with how text boxes worked on Internet Explorer versus Chrome. They worked on Chrome great. If I had a date in there and then I changed it, I would move off of it. I would get a little error message that would pop up and say, hey, that's not a date. Wouldn't work on Internet Explorer. I chased it for 3 hours, Googling it, trying it, stubbing out code, that kind. I finally figured out that if I put a value in the database to begin with, it would work fine in Chrome. It wouldn't work in IE, but if I left it blank to start with, worked perfect in Internet Explorer as well. Went over, talked to another buddy there, and he said, yeah, that's because Internet Explorer, if you put a value in there, even if you change the value, it keeps checking the original value. And so since the original value was a good date, even if you change it to something that's a bad date, it just goes, yep, that's date, that's still good. What? Now, I know several of the programmers that I work with that this would make them mad. I can't believe Microsoft. What? What is wrong with them? Why didn't they fix this? Okay, but see, that's not the approach I take. Because I do not believe that Microsoft knows of my existence and they're doing this just to irritate me, or they're doing just to waste my time and cause me people to think of me as not being a good programmer. I don't believe that at all. And in fact, I realized that, okay, this browser, there's probably 10,000 documented bugs in this browser. And somebody is sitting somewhere trying to figure out what are we going to fix. And they've got a list somewhere. And now that they've moved up to Edge, they're probably not going to be doing much updates to the Internet Explorer. So, you know, that's their decision to make as a business. all that's left for me is to say, okay, what do I need to do to fix this then? What I need to do is I need to write code that works right in place of their code that doesn't work right. And I just need to write a scrap of code that will work as opposed to their code, which doesn't. And I could spend a lot of time getting angry about that, but it's not going to change the fact that at the end of the day, I'm going to have to write this code. So instead of fuming about it, I'll just write it. Because I can get my productivity farther down the road by just doing that, as opposed to being angry about it for a really long time. And not understanding that that is just the flesh within me telling me a story, lying to me about the fact that Microsoft hasn't done something should affect my idea of myself and my definition of myself. That the fact that Microsoft didn't do something is going to affect what people think about me as a programmer. And that's not true. Because I'll just say, yep, there's a bug in Microsoft. And we really needed this to work. And it took me like 3 hours to figure this out, that there was a bug. Sorry. And all the people I know go, yeah, well, that happens sometimes. And we just move on. We just move on and keep going. This is Phil Farron, and I have made it home.